everyone. Welcome back to season 3 of Be the Adult Podcast. I'm so delighted that you are joining me on our journey of learning how to grow ourselves up for our kids. No small task. Please remember to like, share, rate, and review our podcast. We need everyone's support to help us make this important content available to all parents. Thanks so much.
Welcome to the Be the Adult Podcast. Be the Adult is a nonprofit organization that provides blueprints for calm and effective parenting so that children can grow into their best selves. Because ultimately, we aren't raising children. We are raising little people who will one day be adults.
I am so excited to have this guest on today. She comes highly recommended by many people who I think so highly of. Her name is Tina Gilbertson. She is a psychotherapist specializing in estrangement between parents and their adult children. She's the author of 2 books, Reconnecting with Your Estranged Adult Child and Constructive Wallowing, How to Beat Bad Feelings by Letting Yourself Have Them. What a great title. She's the host of the Reconnection Club podcast, a show that helps parents heal their relationships with their adult children and with themselves. Tina has been featured in hundreds of media outlets, including the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, Glamour, and Real Simple. Please check out her website, thereconnectionclub.com, and her podcast. There's so much valuable information on it for all of us. So welcome, Tina. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure to be with you, Nancy, and thank you so much for your podcast and for the service that you provide.
Oh, I appreciate that. It's nice that we are all doing our part to try to create a more peaceful, kinder world, right?
Yeah. Nice.
So I'd love to start by asking you and simple is not the right word, but a basic question with many different answers. Being the adult for your child means different things to different people. So I'm sure if we had 100 of us together in a room, we would get 100 different responses to what does it mean to be the adult. So I'm curious what that means to you.
Yeah, well, I love your approach, actually, to being the adult. I think it really boils it down to the most simple and profound and basic aspects of parenting, as well as just being an adult in the world, and that is the self-regulation aspect. You know, being able to regulate your nervous system, your emotions, and I think that involves also then setting the tone for your relationship with your child. And that's something that I think is true throughout life. Even when your children are, you know, 40, 50 years old, you're still capable, if you're up for it, of setting the tone for those relationships.
Mm. And by setting the tone, can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah. If your child comes at you in a, let's say, a dysregulated state, mm-hmm. and they're upset either with you or with someone else. And of course, as a human being, your tendency may be, and because you love them, your tendency may be to get very upset along with them. But then what you've done is you've kind of met the tone that they're bringing in, which is an upset kind of dysregulated tone of the relationship. So to the extent that, and of course, it's impossible to be perfect at this,
right?
But to the extent that you can remember yourself and remember self-regulation, you can actually change what's going on between you and your child by just stepping down into your adult self, let's call it.
Mm. Right. And we don't mean chronological adult self, we mean.
Right. Right.
Right. So I imagine with the work that you do, that holds true because we're talking about adult with adult primarily, right?
Yes. And parents of adult children who estrange themselves are really vulnerable to getting highly distressed and you know, feeling rejected, and they're just, there's this onslaught potentially of all these terribly negative, strong emotions that really pitch them off course profoundly. Mm-hmm. And so it is often difficult for them to even imagine that they have the power in the relationship to set a better tone. Obviously, if the adult child has stepped away and has become estranged, there's something wrong in the relationship. That something has gone wrong. And often I think the person on the parent side, who is sometimes in just total shock, how did this happen, can't even begin to imagine that they might be able to set the train back on the tracks, or to kind of slow things down and make things better in any way, because they feel they're mostly in a reactive state, like this has happened, and they're reeling from it. So, I mean, realistically, I think it can take some time to get centered again and find your adult self again when you've been so shocked and thrown off and hurt.
Absolutely. And so I can imagine, you know, when we, as a parent, when a small child or a young child is not listening or following directions or says something that doesn't feel so great, it hurts at a certain level. And then I can only imagine as our kids grow that the power of that kind of increases, of that wounding, of that the dysregulation of the gut punch that causes for us.
Yeah, there also seems to be a change that happens as the child becomes more and more an individual, you know, less of the sweet little thing that doesn't know very much and that is just looking for guidance, and more of an individual within himself or herself. Their power to play the role for the parent of somebody judging or somebody who symbolizes for the parent a powerful and potentially harmful person. There's a turning point when that happens, where sometimes the relationship starts to go south as the child more becomes an individual, steps into himself or herself, and perhaps starts to throw things at the parent that the parent isn't ready for and doesn't want, and that remind the parent of other rejections.
That makes a lot of sense, right? So when the adult child triggers within the parent some old wounds.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yes, you've nailed it.
So I would love to ask how you deal with that, right?
Yeah. Well, and that is as you can tell, that's a simple question, but a big question. And I think, as is so often true, the very first step is awareness that there's been a triggering, that, you know, my reaction to your behavior is not, your behavior isn't the whole story behind my reaction, that there's a longer story behind my reaction, that your behavior is just the newest part of, just the most recent event in my story. So becoming aware of the fact that there's a good reason why my hurt is so deep. Mm-hmm. If you do something today that seems perhaps, maybe doesn't seem like that big a deal or something, but I have a big reaction to it. I think it's important to be aware that that's a trigger and not the whole story.
Right. And so when you say trigger, what I imagine when you say that is that I'm something within me, right, is getting activated by a perception that I have that something is a threat at some level. There's a continuum for the word threat, right? But is that
exactly? That is exactly right. So, for example, if I have, if I'm a parent and I have a history of even maybe unconsciously or semi-consciously feeling rejected by important others in my life, that sense of rejection and that fear of rejection, I can go through life kind of putting that in my back pocket and trying not to think about it. And I can move forward and I can have children and have a good life. But then when my child grows up and starts to push away from me, here's this incredibly important person. Mm-hmm. And that old rejection springs back to life. And I say to, I mean, at some level, I'm saying, oh, here it is. I knew I was unworthy. I knew I would always be rejected if somebody really knew me. Now it's come true. This is my worst nightmare come true.
I can imagine how that would feel. It's inherently, as my children age, you know, I always say that one of the kind of cruel ironies of parenting is to grow a child who wants to leave the nest, right? And
exactly.
So there's a lot of loss inherent in that process anyway. Right.
And it seems so simple in nature. Animals, you know, they put their everything into raising their young, and then the young take off without a thanks, and they're just like gone. And the mama lion or whoever, the mother fox, or they're just like, yep, okay, well, I'll just have another brood, and then they'll leave, and that's cool. You know, it they don't seem to have the same attachments that we have.
Right.
Lucky for them, you know.
Right. Right. I was thinking about, well, so I guess when they want to just come home and eat our food, that's a good thing, right? We're getting that re-engagement. So.
Yeah, that's such a complicated thing, you know, because a lot of parents feel used by that as human beings. I mean, I hear that a lot in people that I work with. I only hear from my child when he needs something or when she needs something. And there are a lot of stories about how much, you know, I gave this and I did that for them and they lived with me for 6 weeks when they blah, blah, blah. And I gave them a down payment for this. There's a lot of giving and sacrificing and then feeling kind of used, you know, and it's, that makes a lot of sense because typically in human relationships, it's, we really enjoy a give and take, and we expect a give and take in most human relationships. And this parent-child relationship seems unique in that it is sort of biologically based. And even if you adopt your children, there's still a basis in biology where when you raise young, whether they're, you know, biologically yours or not, you are invested in them in a way that nature doesn't seem to imbue the child with. The child is not as invested in the parent as the parent is in the child. The child is invested in their children. It seems to be unidirectional, right? It goes on down the line. Parents are very interested in their children and grandchildren. Right. The children are interested in their children. The grandchildren are interested in their great-grandchildren and so on. It's a one-way kind of a thing. Obviously, you know, there are lots of us who love our parents to pieces and are very, very much invested in their well-being. But that is sort of, that doesn't seem to be what nature demands in the way that it demands that we look after our young. You know, that's more of an imperative. So even though the parent may feel, you know, very, or may make wry remarks when the kid comes home just to make a sandwich or do laundry.
Right.
The fact is that they're really between a rock and a hard place. Because as humans, yes, I'm feeling used. As a parent, though, my investment in my child means I want him to have clean clothes. That works for me.
Right.
I sleep better if I know he had a sandwich.
Right.
That works for me. So it is more complicated than just I'm a person being used.
Right.
But of course, if I've been used a lot in my life by other adults, then I am really going to struggle and suffer if I feel that my child is doing that to me as well.
Absolutely. So that would be an example of one of the moments, if I circle us back to what you were sharing about setting the tone. We'd have to be even more aware in that moment that the data coming in, you know, rubbed us in a way that was painful, and then
exactly.
Getting ourselves regulated to be able to use that smart part of our brain to.
Exactly. And I think that involves a lot of self-compassion. You know, I have been hurt. This has hurt me in the past and it's happening again. And I'm feeling a lot of pain around it. So part of being aware of it is also, I think, being very gentle with myself. I'm not doing anything wrong by feeling hurt or used. I'm just noticing it. And of course I feel that way. I've had experiences like that in the past and it doesn't feel good.
Listening to what you're saying, I'm filling in the blank for your answer to this question, but why do you feel it's important for us to be the adult, to be aware of the tone that we're setting and our regulation for our kids of all ages?
Yeah. Well, I think that the most important function is providing a blueprint for what it means to be an adult and what adults do in relationships and so on. So when children are small, I think the most important function is modeling. You know, there's can be a lot of confusion around, well, how do I parent properly? And there can be, geez, I have to get this perfect. I have to be someone different. Mm-hmm. I can't just be myself. I have to be like someone better than me. And it's really not that. It is just, if I can master myself, then I'm providing a wonderful example of what a child can grow into. Mm-hmm. A child can grow into somebody who can be all of themselves and also be much of the time a master of their nervous system, let's say, much of the time. I don't think we're ever going to get it right all
right. I know I don't. I love that. I made myself a note, master myself. That's a powerful statement.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, people don't want us to be masters of them.
Right.
But everybody likes to be around someone who is a master of herself or himself. It's soothing mm-hmm. to be in the presence of somebody who is able to self-soothe.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when you said soothing, I was thinking about just that. Like I can, when I'm the master of myself, I can reconnect back to me. If I became dysregulated, I can kind of come back into myself, and that feels soothing, peaceful to me.
Yes. And when you talk about connecting to you, it reminds me that really that's what we need in order to genuinely connect with somebody else. Because when we're feeling fractured inside and disconnected inside, we're not available to truly connect with another person.
Right.
And so relationships suffer if we're not able to access that part that we're calling the adult, mm-hmm. which is the connected, calm individual who is the master of himself or herself.
Mm-hmm. And what a beautiful, like you were talking about modeling, what a beautiful way of being to model for our children. That's what we want from them, right? At any age, right?
Yeah. And being able to be with them, fully with them when they are dysregulated is also an important thing to model. What we're not trying for is everybody being monotone all the time and not having reactions, not crying, not throwing a tantrum, never getting upset. That's not necessary. Mm-hmm. And some people have that as the notion of, well, an emotionally intelligent person is someone who never gets angry. Well, that's not true. To be able to be self-regulated in the presence and connected to someone who's not, that is powerful connection.
Absolutely. And very difficult.
Yeah. And very difficult is absolutely right.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember where I heard you say this. I think it was on one of your podcasts that, you know, we don't grow by avoiding difficulties.
That
reminds me of that when you're talking about, you know, this place we all strive to be, but it's hard.
It's so hard. I think a lot of what we want is on the other side of discomfort. Mm-hmm. It feels so good to just go inside a silo and feel like, okay, I've got it. I'm holding on. I'm in control. I'm not in distress right now. I'm just going to be behind this wall, you know, unto myself and just be quiet and still and then everything will be good. But, and it's true. I mean, you can, there are times, I think, to hibernate, to go inside, to be still and quiet and alone. I don't have a problem with that. But I think those are periods of rest rather than growth.
Beautiful. Say that. Mm-hmm.
I think growth is more active. And in terms of with human beings and in relationships, I believe, this is just a personal opinion, I don't know, but it seems to me that most growth does happen in the context of relationships and relating to other people because it's difficult. Mm-hmm. It's just like growing a muscle, right? You lift a weight, it's hard, your muscle fibers tear. And in the repair of those muscle fibers, there is growth in the muscle. If you never lifted a weight, your muscles would not grow.
Absolutely.
Unless you were a child and they were, you know, growing because nature makes them grow to a certain degree.
I was thinking for a moment, I know I've had many of these moments when my children were younger, and sometimes when they're, you know, they're young adults now, that I just want to lock them in a room so they're safe, right? Because
sure.
They're bubble wrapped or, you know, never leave the house, then my anxiety can come down and I don't have to sit in that uncomfortable space of trusting that they're going to make good decisions. And
oh, that is so true. Sometimes their growth and our growth is on the other side of discomfort about them. So it's not just a personal growth thing. It's watching children grow and tolerating the discomfort of not being able to feel certain that they're safe or that they're not in distress. You know, there's that saying, you're only as happy as your unhappiest child. And that's just so hard not to want to spare them that and trusting. It's hard to trust that that is actually a growth path.
Yeah.
Suffering can be a path of growth. There is suffering along the path of growth.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the segue into my next question, which is something else that I feel is very difficult to do, is that often I myself and work with parents who really cognitively know, you know, what they quote should be doing, what the textbooks are saying and what they've learned. And yet in that moment, right, we become this person that we kind of do a double take, like, who is that? What is coming out of her mouth? What is she saying? So we know in the moment that what we're doing, or maybe after the moment, wasn't really the best and wasn't our best, at least from what we know. But in the moment, it is our best. So I guess you can hear my emotion, my brain getting muddled. So I'm putting myself in that moment. What do you think is happening there that we have that disconnect between what we know and what we do?
I think when there is a gap between knowing and doing, it's a moment of potentially dysregulation where we have been caught off guard. We're not prepared. I think preparation is often the difference between how we want to react and how we do react. If we're going into a situation we can prepare for, then we're more likely to be able to kind of steel ourselves ahead of time against how we might react and just kind of remind ourselves, okay, here's the game plan. Here's what I'm going to do. But so much in life comes at us without our knowledge, without pre-knowledge. And so we're not able to prepare. And so, yeah, we do react in the moment. And that is human. Mm-hmm. That's human. We're not robots. We don't live with an algorithm. We are never going to be able to live in such a way that we will never react badly to something, I don't think.
Right.
So in those, I think what's happening is we're getting hijacked. Our brains are getting hijacked. And yeah, that happens. And so then the plan becomes, well, how do I, after the fact, how do I deal with the fact that I was hijacked? That's where things like apologies come in. And they are really a wonderful relationship repair tool.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of that repair, of that apology, what that might look like
sure.
in your work? Or
yeah, well, I just write, in my work.
Oh, or any example would be great. So,
well, let's say you say something to me that reminds me of something that's hurt me in the past, and I snap at you. I say, what do you mean by that, Nancy? Why would you bring that up? You know that hurts me. Mm-hmm. And you stand there agape, just looking at me like, what did I get into? I don't even know. But so then if I realize after the fact, oh my gosh, I snapped at Nancy because I felt attacked. But now that I'm thinking about it, I realize Nancy had no idea that what she said would have made me feel that way. So then I go back and I say, Nancy, I've got to apologize. I'm so sorry I snapped at you. I was triggered by what you said. It's not at all your fault. What you said was, you know, I understand why you said it, but I got triggered and that made me snap at you. And I'm so sorry, you know, if I hurt your feelings, because I sure didn't mean to. And I hope you can forgive me.
Hmm. So I felt my self lighten. I knew you weren't mad at me, but I felt my body tighten when you were snapped, right? And I know we're just role playing, but it's really interesting what I noticed. And then I felt my body lighten when you held yourself accountable.
Yeah, that's the power of a good apology that is specific and takes accountability and expresses understanding and remorse and validates your experience. You know, I think I fear that I hurt your feelings when I snapped at you. And I can understand that because I really did snap. And I'm so sorry that I did that.
Yeah. And you're modeling for your child too, if you're interacting with a child, right?
Yes.
How you would want them to be. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I think too often people demand apologies of children without ever giving them a model for what an apology looks like.
Mm. So true.
And the best way to teach a child apologizing, I feel, is to do it, to show them what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Can you think of other ways that we can help ourselves? I heard you saying to try to be proactive in setting ourselves up, or what's the word you use? Sorry, with the
preparing.
Preparing, thank you. Preparing for engagement. Can you think of some other tools that might be helpful for us?
I think that mindfulness is a very useful tool. Any mindfulness practice that encourages us to just sit with ourselves and notice our internal experience, that's something that I don't think you can just pull out of a hat when you need it. I think it's a practice that you kind of need to be. I'm just thinking about my own mindfulness practice, which is poor because it's not very consistent. Mm. But that's something that I would like to make more regular so that it is ready, like kind of like a fire drill, really knowing what's going to happen when the alarm goes, going through, taking the steps, walking the path out the door to down the fire escape, really doing that regularly. That is the only way that when there is a fire, you're just going to bang, you're going to go to the right door, you're going to go down the fire escape, you're going to know exactly what to do. If you were shown the fire drill protocol once 5 years ago, you might have a sense that the door's over there. Maybe there was something about standing around. You know, that's very different from practicing like weekly or even monthly a fire drill. So a regular practice of mindfulness, I think, is going to make it more likely that you have the ability in the moment to notice what's going on inside of you and to take steps like breathing and physical relaxation to regulate what's going on.
Absolutely. A great analogy. And so I was thinking about when you were talking about building that muscle, right?
Exactly right. It's the same idea. Yeah. And you don't do strength training once a month.
Right.
Yeah. Well, once a year.
Right. Yeah. I don't get much
unless
stronger.
You do.
Right. Yeah, I love that. So can you think of any other tools that you might offer that could be helpful with setting that tone or the regulation of awareness?
Yeah. Well, one of my go-tos, one of my favorites is self-compassion. Mm. And it's a difficult one for many, many people. Some times it feels fake when we are kind to ourselves. And if that's true, if I look in the mirror and I say, I love you, you are a wonderful person, and I'm so glad to have you in my heart. If I look in the mirror and say that and I scoff at myself, or I make a disgusted face, or I think this is ridiculous, mm-hmm. that's a clue, a big clue, that I do not have sufficient self-compassion. And it's possibly true that I have not received enough compassion in my life from important others. Mm. But if I'm walking around in the world without having a good relationship with myself, it's going to be much harder for me to relate well with others and to offer them what they need when they're not doing well or when they're mad at me.
Absolutely. I can relate to that. So when someone is aware that they maybe didn't, receive enough compassion to help them internalize that, do you have any ideas that where somebody could start?
Yeah. Not a small thing to introduce self-compassion once you're an adult. I think it is doable. One vehicle is therapy, of course, being with a therapist whose approach is not, let's fix you, let's change you, let's get you on the right path, but let's accept you exactly as you are right now. Let's know you and appreciate who you are. If you can find a therapist who gives you a regular experience of being accepted, understood, heard, cared about, and validated, that provides a model, an internal model that you can then use to provide self-compassion for yourself. But even before that, there has to be a part of you that says, I deserve maybe to have this experience of self-compassion. As long as there is a ridiculing or a minimizing of the idea mm-hmm. of self-compassion, you're kind of stuck at square one.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest hurdle.
Mm-hmm. So it's feeling worthy. I deserve.
Yeah, or yes, and or recognizing that, yes, you're worthy, and it matters. This matters that I don't have self-compassion. That's a problem mm-hmm. that deserves fixing, and I deserve a better experience.
Mm, I love that.
I'm reminded of my book, Constructive Wallowing. I often think, that's just a book about how to sit with difficult feelings and really be there for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I often say of that book, I wrote it for the people who will never read it. Because there is someone out there who looks at that title and says, ugh, yuck, I hate wallowing. I would never read a book like that. And that's who I wrote it for. It's unfortunate, but I feel that it's true. Mm-hmm. So the biggest hurdle is the very beginning is looking at the concept and going, I want to explore that, even though I feel disgusted by it and like it's not for me.
So even though it's hard, here we go again, right? The growth comes in the hard places. And your book is wonderful. Everything that I've read or listened to by you, it helps me grow. So I thank you for
thank
all
you.
Of that. So I have a question. I get a lot of parents who will say, I see more parents who have younger kids, and they'll say, what can I do to prevent my child someday from X, Y, or Z? So I try to redirect them to the moment, right? And kind of what are we doing now that's taking good care of them, and what are we doing that's not, that awareness. Can you speak to that for a moment, and any advice you can offer?
So when you say, I want to prevent my child from doing this, are you talking about, I want to keep them from getting a tattoo one day, or for what are you?
Fill in the blank with anything. Parents will come in and, it's fraught with anxiety of, especially nowadays. It's my job to prevent my child from doing anything in the world that will cause them harm or discomfort or cause me harm or discomfort. So I get a lot of the kind of forward thinking and the anxiety of, well, what if they do this, this, or this? So, yeah.
So what immediately comes to mind for me is two words, trust and acceptance.
Love it.
So the acceptance is accepting that your child may be a very different person mm-hmm. from you and may want to do things that you would never, ever dream of and may make choices that you never would have made. Mm-hmm. And that is them. And the idea that you have, that you would want to accept your child, even if they make, you know, decisions that you think are crazy, that's a tough one. Mm-hmm. The acceptance, because I cannot accept if my child wants to do this. I just can't accept that. The other piece is trust your child that if you are doing your best to model self-compassion, compassion for others, being an adult and being responsible and being a good person, trust that your child, you know, that'll go in and your child will do with that what he's able and willing to do. But at a certain point, you just have to step back and trust that the relationship you've established, the tools that you have offered uh-huh. are going to be used.
Wonderful. I love that. To me, that's such a concrete thing that we can do now. It's in this present moment. How am I taking, what am I modeling as the adult, right? What is the tone I'm setting that is taking good care of my child? And chances are it will, if I continue to show up that way, it will continue to take good care of them and the relationship, right?
Yes. And another word is uh-huh. respect.
Oh.
Respect. The more respect I show my child as a human being, the more they are likely to respect me for the rest of my life. Respect is learned in that way. You know, I think we learn respect from receiving it, just like compassion. A lot of good things we learn by receiving them, and it's harder to learn in other ways. But if you're concerned that your child will do something in the future, if you show them a basic respect for their human dignity, then you can trust that when the time comes and you have an opinion about what they're doing, mm-hmm. they will possibly be inclined to want to hear from you and to respect your opinion.
Mm. They have that felt sense of safety with us, right? When they feel respected.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Mm. I'm so glad you brought that up. I felt that all through me, that respect is so important. And I think a lot of us, you know, don't think about that with our children.
Oh no. Well, there's so many things to think about with children, just keeping them alive and giving them basic training in life.
Yes.
It's a 24/7 job. And so something as squishy as respect uh-huh. or self-esteem or any of these other kinds of concepts, I mean, they are not at the forefront of what comes to mind when I think when most people think of parenting. I think they think of taking care of and training and, you know, raising good citizens mm-hmm. who say please and thank you and, you know.
The basics, right?
The basics.
Yeah, and then especially nowadays, the survival skills too, unfortunately. So
that's right, yeah.
With what's going on. So, well, this has been so wonderful. Is there anything that you want our listeners to take with them, especially from all of the wonderful things that you've shared today? Anything you want to highlight or add before we close?
Yes, I want to highlight that you really don't have to be different. Mm-hmm. A different person or a better person than you already are. You certainly don't have to be perfect. And there's never been a human in existence who was perfect. And you don't have to be even close. You just have to be yourself. But the kind of fullest expression of yourself is really a gift to your child and to everyone else.
Mm. Beautiful. And to ourselves, right?
Exactly.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I highly recommend that if you're listening to this podcast, you check out Tina's work. It's just really invaluable nuggets.
Thank you.
To hold. And it's been lovely getting to know you and just appreciate your time and wish you the best. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. You too.